This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many Americans don't know much about Singapore, except that it's the small island country where in 1993, the young American Michael Fay was imprisoned and caned after being convicted of acts of vandalism. Singapore is also an economic success story. My guest, Lee Kuan Yew, is considered the father of independent Singapore and is one of the more interesting and paradoxical heads of state. For example, he's been praised for leading his country from poverty to riches through his smart economic management, but he's been criticized for creating an authoritarian government that restricts the civil liberties of its citizens and tries to regulate their lives. Lee Kuan Yew became Singapore's first prime minister at the age of 35 in 1959, after the end of Britain's colonial rule. 10 years ago, he stepped down and became the senior minister. He's written a new book called From Third World to First, The Singapore Story. I asked Lee Kuan Yew what living conditions were like in Singapore when he became prime minister.
Fairly dreadful for the vast majority, excellent for the wealthy minority of about 5 to 10%. People lived in shanty huts made of discarded soap boxes and zinc planks and for the roof. And you have a hole in the ground for your toilet, no drainage. So it's a pretty grim existence, because before then there was 4.5 years of 3.5 years of Japanese occupation. And then the long period of rehabilitation in a very poverty-stricken world after the World War. So it was tough.
Now, one of the things you felt was necessary to do when you became the Prime Minister in 1959 was to redistribute the wealth. Why was that important, and what do you think are the most important steps you took toward redistributing the wealth?
Well, if you want to enthuse people to join you to throw the British out, you've got to hold out to them the expectation of some benefit. And the benefit was, we'll share all these fine things that British had. But, of course, there are more people to share than there were fine things. So the next problem is, how do we create more fine things? And that was the beginning of our learning process.
Is it fair to say that your approach was to try to attract multinational corporations and get them to set up shop in Singapore?
Well, that was later on. First, we tried it, do-it-yourself, DIU sort of, you know. We didn't realize that it was a difficult business, that creating wealth was not a simple business of just planting coconuts or papaya and bananas. It's a different world. If you plant coconuts, papayas, and bananas, then you don't make much of a living. It's when you have educated people and they know how to make use of machines, and then you are able to add value, much more value than if you worked with your bare hands and simple implements, that we learn how to make a better life. And we keep on learning how to do that all the time, because the implements change with computers, with robotics, and there is no end to this process of learning and relearning, which is sweeping across the whole world and not just Singapore.
Well, how did you try to improve education in Singapore and get more people into school?
That's the crucial part. I mean, do you educate your people? Do you give them the basic knowledge and give them the zest to learn on their own? We had a very mixed and difficult series of languages. The British kept us separate. So Chinese spoke a series of their own 6 or 7 different dialects. Indians spoke 3 or 4 different languages. And Malays spoke 3 or 4 of their different dialects. We decided that all will learn English, and that will become our common language. And so that you can get everybody into a factory and they understand each other. And what we didn't expect then, turned out to be a bit of serendipity, was the world decided to use English. This was even before the internet. And multinationals, when they came, whether they were Germans or French or Japanese, they spoke English too. So it was an immense benefit to us.
Now, in the United States, a very controversial subject is whether there should be Spanish in classrooms that have a lot of Latino people in it. You know, whether English should be the only language in school or whether other languages should be allowed as well. How controversial was your move to make English the language in school in Singapore? And what, you know, what reaction did you get to that? And how did you deal with the reaction?
Language is a very emotional subject, very emotive. People cling on tenaciously to their mother tongue because that's what they learned to speak to their mother in whilst they were still suckling at the mother's breast. So if you tell them to drop their mother language, then you have a lot of trouble. So what we did was, you can go to any school of your choice to learn your mother tongue, if you wish, but you will also learn English as a second language, or if you prefer to do better in English, then you go to school teaching you English as a first language and your mother tongue as a second language. Now, at the first few years, during the first few years, many chose mother tongue, first language, English, second language. But when they went into the job market, they discovered that English as a first language got better jobs. So the parents too soon got the hang of it and switched their precious boys and girls into English as the first language. And they study their mother tongue as a second language. So that solved the problem without too much trauma. It took about 20 years. Can't be done too quickly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lee Kuan Yew. He's the founding prime minister of Singapore, now the senior minister. He stepped down as prime minister in 1990. What is the rate of home ownership in Singapore now?
About 95%.
And how did you accomplish that?
Well, we set out in 1963-64 to create a special fund, which we call a Central Provident Fund, where the worker puts in about 10, later on 15, and ultimately 20% of his earnings. And the employer matches it. So it's either 10 and 10, or 15 and 15, or 20 and 20. So from this fund, he will be able to buy his home and save for his pensions when he retires, and also for his co-payment for subsidized medical treatment. At the same time, we made it possible because we sold these apartments to them at below market prices. We charged them the cost of the building, but the land was given at below cost. The land belonged to the government, and it was given below cost. So what happens is, about 5, 10, 15 years after they've paid their installments, they've got a substantial asset. If you have a three-room apartment, today it's worth about 100,000 to 120,000 US. If you've got a five-room apartment, you would have about 220,000 US worth of assets. And that's spread across the whole population. So that provides for stability. I mean, when you own that asset, you don't want to elect a government that may cause your assets to drop in value.
So home ownership, you're saying, gives people a vested interest in maintaining the status quo?
Absolutely. Without that, we wouldn't have been reelected so confidently each time. We've won 9 successive elections since 1959. And had we not done that, had we had them pay ferocious rents for small little cubicles and the landlords had creamed off their salaries, we might not have seen our second term.
Now, in terms of the economic base in Singapore, one of the ways you strengthened that was to invite in multinationals and create an environment that they would want to set up shop in.
Yes.
What are some of the things you did to create that environment that you thought would be welcoming to multinationals?
Well, first, we remember when we started in 1959, we were a third world country. In other words, third world standards. Now, to attract business and investments, if you want companies to sink hundreds of millions of dollars, you've got to give them first world infrastructure and the people to match that infrastructure so that it works at first world standards. I mean, you can buy top-rate telecoms equipment, but if you don't have people who can work it properly and the power supply is on 24 hours and not collapse every few hours with brownouts and so on, then you've got to train your people. That was the hard part, jacking them up from third world to second and ultimately first world standards. It's a tough job, but it can be done provided the people are motivated and they know what is at stake.
My guest is Lee Kuan Yew, Singapore's founding prime minister and current senior minister. He's written a new book called From Third World to First. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lee Kuan Yew, and he is the former prime minister of Singapore. He was the founding prime minister, and since 1990, he's been the senior minister of his country. He's written a book about Singapore called From Third World to First. I think everybody is in agreement about the economic success of Singapore. However, the country is also considered very authoritarian. In 1990, which is the year that you stepped down as Prime Minister of Singapore, the Ford Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation issued a report, and they said, "What emerges from this review is a government that has been willing to decimate the rule of law for the benefit of its political interests. Lawyers have been cowed into passivity. Judges are kept on a short leash. And the law has been manipulated so that gaping holes exist in the system of restraints on government action toward individuals. Singapore is not a country in which individual rights have significant meaning." And in 1991, the State Department in the U.S. issued a report, and they described political control of the press, courts, and religion, and mistreatment of detainees, and surveillance of opposition or dissident figures, as well as surveillance of some religious leaders. Would you agree that Singapore is authoritarian?
It depends upon your definition of authoritarian. If you mean by authoritarian that we are subject to the will of the people, that we derive our authority to govern from the votes of the people, which they regularly cast in secret ballot every 4 to 5 years, and our policies are completely transparent, and they know what they're voting for, and they solidly voted us in, and we used to win almost 95, or more than 95% of the seats. Now, at the end of the day, I'm not interested in what the MacArthur Foundation or... What was your other foundation you mentioned?
The Ford Foundation.
The Ford Foundation says, look at the rating agencies. The World Economic Forum, IMD, they're all Geneva-based. They sell their reports, and they are used by investors to decide where to put their money.
Well, that's the whole point, though.
That's my point. We have been rated as the second most competitive economy in the world, next to the United States, with the best standards in the rule of law, administration, clean government, and Transparency International in Berlin has rated us for the last 6 years as amongst the top 7 cleanest governments in the world and the cleanest in Asia. Now, these are independent rating agencies. They are not out to crusade to change the world as Ford or MacArthur Foundation hopes to change, make it a better world. All they do is to say, here's the list of 80-odd countries that they have studied, and this is the ranking. And our rule of law, our judges, the way we handle, the confidence of the people and of the investors in our judiciary is unquestioned.
But I think the point that your critics are trying to make is that the price that the people of Singapore have paid for their economic prosperity is the price of losing a lot in terms of human rights and civil liberties.
Ask the Singaporean that. And ask him to vote again. Ask him to vote the PAP.
My impression is that some Singaporeans would be afraid to talk the truth about that because they're afraid that they would be punished for it.
How are they punished? Show me somebody who's been punished.
Well, I can't name names there, but for instance, Stan Sesser, who wrote about Singapore for the New Yorker magazine a few years ago, described a ruthless and efficient and intrusive intelligence agency that is tireless in its pursuit of dissent.
Stan Sesser is a good friend of mine. He wrote that, but he didn't know Singapore very well. I think he wrote that for the New Yorker, right?
Yes.
Well, since then, he's got to know us better. He then wrote up a more informed piece, which the New Yorker never published, and it's left the New Yorker. I meet my critics. I do not run away from them.
Now, you talk about how many times your government has been reelected. My understanding is that there really isn't a strong opposition party. And I think that kind of dissent might not be that well tolerated in Singapore.
No. How do you get to grow if the government is honest, effective, efficient, and spreads wealth equally? My job is to prevent dissatisfaction, which leads to violent protests, riots, and civil commotion, which will destroy the economy. And because I have succeeded, therefore the opposition has not succeeded. That's the whole purpose of government. That's what I thought democratic governments are supposed to do. If you look after your people, the opposition won't stand much of a chance the next time round.
Now, in your chapter about press restrictions,
yes,
you're describing how if you think a foreign press report has misreported a story about Singapore or slanted a story, yes, on Singapore, they have to publish your reply unedited or else,
yes,
you restrict their sales.
Yeah.
And you say, if we don't stand up to and answer our critics from the foreign media, Singaporeans, especially journalists and academics, will believe that their leaders are afraid of or unequal to the argument and will lose respect for us.
Quite right.
Can't you also argue that journalists and academics in particular will lose respect for a government that doesn't respect free speech?
That's not been the case. We have commanded respect because we have argued our case, whether it's a local journalist or a foreign journalist. Now, the local journalists can hit us as hard as they like, but we have the right of reply, and we take them on in the argument, and if they lose the argument, they then lose face, and the next time round, when the columnist writes his clever little witty piece, he hasn't got so many plaudits around.
What are some of the publications that aren't allowed to be distributed in Singapore?
None.
What about Playboy, Cosmopolitan?
That's part of our puritanical past. And with the internet, that's becoming obsolete. I mean, we can't stop what's coming through the internet.
But what about on the newsstands? Are they allowed on the newsstands?
No, I think there's still a certain puritanical streak in the population. For instance, about 8 years ago, one of our younger minister for the arts decided to free the film scene from censorship. And so he let through what would have been previously censored. That was an enormous protest from parents. And so he had to step back and have an R rated for artistic, so that you're warned that you must be over 18 years old, and only those with an artistic or aesthetic sense should watch such films. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Singapore has a lot of control. The government controls a lot of public behavior. I think chewing gum was made illegal. Yes.
Yes.
Why is chewing gum illegal?
Because our transition from third world to first was done in one generation. And whilst we were able to transform the physical environment from third world to first world, we are unable to change social habits in that short period of time. So we had a lot of young children and not so young ones who will take the chewing gum and stick it into keyholes of people's doors so that you can't open your door. Or you stick it at the sensitive part of the train doors, the automatic train doors, so that it will not keep closing. It will touch and it will reopen. Well, You can cane them for that, but the easier thing is to ban the chewing gum, and that has brought about a dramatic decline in vandalism of clogged locks and train doors which do not close.
What is the fine for chewing gum or selling chewing gum?
I can't tell you, because it's not the fine that's the deterrent, it's the confiscation before you bring it in. We stop it at source. First, we don't manufacture chewing gum. Next, we make sure it isn't brought in.
Lee Kuan Yew is the founding Prime Minister of Singapore and the current senior minister. He's written a new book called From Third World to First. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lee Kuan Yew. In 1959, at the age of 35, he became the founding Prime Minister of Singapore after the end of Britain's colonial rule. He stepped down 10 years ago and is now the country's senior minister. In his new book, From Third World to First, he writes about leading his country from poverty to prosperity. His critics acknowledge his economic achievements, but point out that they've come at a price. Lee Kuan Yew created an authoritarian government which restricts the civil liberties of its citizens. Now, one thing that's gotten a lot of attention in the United States is the use of caning as punishment in Singapore. Some of the crimes for which caning is a punishment include breaking into a house, stealing a car. What are some of the other crimes punishable by caning as well as prison?
Vandalism, destruction of private and public property.
And in 1993, the American Michael Fay, who pleaded guilty for vandalizing road traffic signs and spray painting cars, was given the punishment. Well, the judge ordered 6 strokes of the cane, and that was worked down to 4 strokes and 4 months in jail.
Yes. It went down to 4 strokes because President Clinton appealed to my prime minister, mm-hmm. who decided that he had to respond to show respect for President Clinton, but we could not cancel all the caning because then we would be unable to contain the other crimes committed by thousands and thousands of others who will not have the privilege of having the American president intervene on their behalf.
Some people consider caning a pretty barbaric approach to punishing. Why do you support it?
Well, you know, people like Amnesty International believe that we should be kind to all wrongdoers because it's really they are the victims of society and you shouldn't hang them and you should be send them to prison in order to rehabilitate them. Well, it's not led to a kinder, gentler world. We have found that let me put it very simply. Supposing we put illegal immigrants into jails and don't cane them, we would soon have to build so many jails that there'll be more jails than tourist hotels in Singapore. Because for the simple reason that the food that they get in these jails is Michelin 3-star compared to what they would be getting in their home countries. So we'll be just inundated. So when we cane them, 6 of the best, and then send them packing off.
6 of the best wax, you mean?
Yeah, 6 of the best wax on the bottom. We reduce the inflow of such economic migrants. It's harsh, but which is harsher? To have them come in and inundate us and ruin what we're doing in Singapore? Surely we have the right to protect what we have created.
Well, you're caning illegal immigrants, you're also caning your own citizens.
Yes, of course. No discrimination.
The impression that I get from your book is that you think that the United States and some other Western countries put too much of an emphasis on human rights.
I wouldn't say put too much of an emphasis on human rights. I mean, the whole purpose of human civilization surely must be to improve the standing of human beings, whatever they are, whatever society they live in. But if you expect all of a sudden, because you are interested in human rights, to make societies which are so far behind in history and development to behave up to your standards, then you are creating a problem for them and for yourself because they can't behave that way. I mean, you look at what has happened in the Moluccas or in East Timor and West Timor. It's hell broken loose. I mean, it's just a complete loss of human values, striking out madly because, I don't know, their world must have collapsed and I don't understand what benefit they get out of it. But in that situation, can you apply human rights? I think what you got to do is to apply law and order, restore order, never mind human rights, just stop it. And to stop it, you need force. And the Indonesians must be encouraged to use their armed forces and their police to stop it.
My guest is Lee Kuan Yew, Singapore's founding prime minister and current senior minister. He's written a new book called From Third World to First. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lee Kuan Yew, Singapore's founding prime minister and current senior minister. I want to just get back to something we were talking about earlier, which is certain things that are illegal in Singapore. What are the laws against homosexuality in Singapore?
Well, we are, with British 19th century laws on homosexuality, which is on the statute book, but we have not prosecuted anybody for homosexuality for the last 40, 50 years. But it's on the statute book, and if you molest somebody and try and make him a homosexual, particularly if he's a minor, then the law will be enforced. It's a question of judgment. Once we conclude that homosexuality is also a DNA problem, then you've got to approach the punishment in a different way. And if you have consenting adults, well, God bless both of them.
God bless both of them, only if you find DNA evidence or...
No. Only if they do not inveigle and draw in innocent young boys mm-hmm. who are not with that inclination.
Now, why not just take the laws off the books? I mean, for example, you can say, well, you know, these laws aren't being used to persecute people, but say you're a homosexual who's also a political dissident. You might think, well, this would, you know, convicting me of homosexuality would be a handy way of getting me into prison so I can't protest things I oppose in the government. So, you know, you never really know where you stand when there's a law on the books that's not really being used, but it could be used.
Well, we've not had any dissident or any opposition member who's a gay or a lesbian, so the question doesn't arise, really. It's not an issue, not even with the opposition. If the opposition raises it, they may well lose votes with the conservative parents.
You know, I've noticed that every time I ask you about criticism of your country, especially those having to do with what is perceived as human rights violations, you laugh. And I'm wondering...
Well, because I think it is absurd. Because if you are right, if the reports you read about is right, then Singapore must be a hell of a hole to be in. But as I told you, we've got 1 million out of 4 million who are foreigners, happy to come to Singapore, willing to work there, and wanting to stay on. Now, you tell me if that's right or wrong. Something must be going on right.
Well, I mean, let's put aside a question of right or wrong. Let me
put democracy and human rights thing in perspective. If you look at the Philippines, and you say, well, people's power, wonderful, you've overthrown a dictator, you've had an election, all's fine. Well, they're exporting hundreds of thousands of maids and construction workers all over the world. They can't find jobs. All right, let's have some balance. I mean, in Kosovo, because it was Europe, you bombed the Serbs into submission. But in East Timor and West Timor, because they were Asians, having voted and been assured by the United Nations that they could vote freely, tens of thousands were massacred or brutalized, and the whole place was razed to the ground. Now, you tell me, where's human rights? These are double standards, are they not?
Well, I think your point in terms of Singapore is that you've been able to accomplish what you have economically because of the tight controls that you've had.
Yeah.
That you couldn't, you feel you couldn't have done one without the other.
I am not prepared to tell you whether we could have done it by being gentle. If I spent all my time saying, please, ladies and gentlemen, let's do it this way, we might never have got started. I looked them in the eye and I said, look, you're hungry. I'm supposed to feed you. Now let's get a move on. You start learning, send your children to school, you start working. Let's do it better. Let's make a better place out of Singapore. We'll build you houses, you'll own them. We'll have schools, we'll have hospitals, we'll have parks, we'll have all the things that you want. And now they own their homes. They've got 80 or 90% with computers. The internet penetration rate is about 30% of all homes. And all homes are wired optic fiber broadband. All we are waiting for is broadband across the Pacific, and we can have broadband streaming into Singapore. Now, you tell me that's right or wrong. Surely that means a different Singapore. But we must have a Singapore that's ready to accept that broadband. And I think it is ready. It will change, but it will not become a Western society altogether. It will not stay what it is, but it is not going to become Americanized. It's not possible.
When you say it won't become Americanized, what are some of the things that you think of as American that you don't think your country will partake
well,
of? Yeah.
Well, I'm your guest, and I'm speaking to Americans, so I would put it in a very circumspect way. I was staying in a very posh hotel in New York not too long ago, and out in the cold, this was nearly winter, November, were beggars huddling in doorways. And some, of course, were blowing trumpets with a hat out. You have an underclass. It's a highly competitive society, and winner takes big prizes. Losers get nothing. Well, we are an Asian, we are a different society. We like to make sure that nobody is dispossessed. And if there are beggars out in the streets, we take them and put them into proper homes, check their background, and some of them are professional beggars. Then we punish them. You know, some deliberately inflict wounds on themselves, make them fester into sores, and then go out and knock on the car windows and say, please help me. Well, that's unacceptable. The government and society owes an obligation to see that everybody gets a chance to make a decent living. But you can only do that if you accept responsibility for winners and for losers. Now, what I see of American society is winners do very well, losers do very poorly. And I think that's not acceptable in my part of the world.
Lee Kuan Yew, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lee Kuan Yew is the founding Prime Minister of Singapore and the current senior minister. His new book is called From Third World to First. Earlier in our conversation, I quoted some criticisms about his authoritarian government's suppression of dissent. The quote was from a 1992 article in The New Yorker by Stan Sesser, a journalist who writes about Asia and is currently based in Bangkok. He's a former senior fellow at the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley. Since Lee dismissed Sesser's criticism, we wanted to give Sesser a chance to respond, so we called him and played back that excerpt of the interview. Stan Sesser, who wrote about Singapore for The New Yorker magazine a few years ago, described a ruthless and efficient and intrusive intelligence agency that is tireless in its pursuit of dissent.
Stan Sesser is a good friend of mine. He wrote that, but he didn't know Singapore very well. I think he wrote that for The New Yorker, right?
Yes.
Well, since then, he's got to know us better. He then wrote up a more informed piece, which The New Yorker never published, and it's left The New Yorker.
Stan Sesser, was that an accurate description? And what was the subsequent piece that you wrote? What did you say in that piece?
Well, the article was about Singapore creating an art scene because it felt it had to create an art scene to draw the foreign business community to work in Singapore. So it set out to buy an art scene, but at the same time didn't lessen its censorship. And that was a fascinating contradiction. How do you build an art scene and at the same time censor everything, vet all plays, censor all movies? That's what the article was about. It was killed when the former editor, Tina Brown, decided that it wasn't timely enough because she was very into running articles that were very timely, and killed for that reason, not really for the content. And I think that, like anything else that would be accurate about Singapore, the article was not favorable and not unfavorable, but expressed the contradictions that are so apparent in Singaporean government.
As your first article did, so I think Lee Kuan Yew was implying you had a change of heart. That wouldn't be true?
No change of heart. No change of heart. Singapore hasn't. My change of heart will come when Singapore changes, and it hasn't changed at all.
Now, Lee Kuan Yew's main point, I think, is that, yes, certain freedoms may be restricted in Singapore, but most people own their own homes, most people are prospering, and unlike most other post-colonial countries in the region, there aren't constant revolutions or civil wars or ethnic fighting. People aren't fighting in the streets. What's your observations about the trade-offs in Singapore between an authoritarian government and economic prosperity?
Well, this is what the government of China is trying to do, the idea that if economic prosperity comes to a country, people won't care about civil liberties. Unfortunately, there's some truth to that, but there's a middle ground. Look at Taiwan and look at South Korea. You can have democracy and you can have economic prosperity at the same time. And you don't need a dictatorship. You don't need a crackdown on civil liberties. Taiwan has certainly had tumultuous periods in its history recently, and so has South Korea. But they're flourishing democracies, and people can believe what they want and say what they want and be critical of the government and also own their homes and send their kids to good colleges. So you don't have to have dictatorship. It's not the only alternative.
What's your impression of how Singaporeans feel about the trade-off between an authoritarian government and economic prosperity?
I think they're very happy with it, which is one of the great ironies, because the government is so fearful of its political opposition that it's essentially nullified the opposition, not by throwing people in jail like happened in Malaysia, but simply by bringing libel suits and various harassments and driving the opposition to silence.
So when Lee Kuan Yew says that Singaporeans must approve of what he's done because his government keeps getting reelected, and he says, my job is to prevent dissatisfaction, that's why there's no opposition, is he being completely accurate there?
Well, he's made certain that there's no opposition. The government controls the electoral process, and they can do various things, like various civil suits against opposition leaders for, it's a very complicated thing, but they're very clever. They don't throw people in jail for political purposes. They just find something that, some tax law or something else, and silence them that way. But I still think that even if there were complete freedom in Singapore and freedom to criticize the government, that Lee Kuan Yew's political action party would still get reelected time and again, because Singaporeans do not want to imperil their prosperity. That's very true. It's a conservative Chinese society. It's been made more conservative by having Big Brother, the government, watch their every move. And people are not, the opposition has never really gotten itself together or been allowed to get itself together. Can't hold demonstrations, whatever. And I think people are would be hesitant to throw the government out. I think they do in fact value their economic prosperity more than they would value civil liberties.
What are some of the civil liberties that the people of Singapore have had to give up under the Lee Kuan Yew government?
Well, you can't. My goodness! Wow, we can start from A to Z, but basically no demonstrations are allowed for any reason whatsoever. Any demonstrator would be immediately arrested. Gays are harassed constantly. Sodomy is punishable by life imprisonment. Their censorship of movies, scripts of plays have to be cleared in advance. And basically, no one can say anything. Oh, the press is totally muzzled. It's government-owned. No one can say anything critical of the government. And everyone feels the government looking over its shoulder. Even when they're on the Internet, people are afraid.
How often are those sodomy laws actually put into practice? The impression I had from Lee Kuan Yew is that there are certain laws that are on the books that, you know, aren't really used to punish anyone.
There was recently a case in Singapore which was quite remarkable. A wife got divorced from her husband and was so angry at her husband, she turned him in for having oral sex with her. And oral sex, even in a heterosexual relationship, is a crime in Singapore. This went all the way up to the appeals level, and the appeals court ruled that oral sex in Singapore was legal only when it was preliminary to sexual intercourse. If you have oral sex and stop right there, you're breaking the law. Now, this is the sort of thing that's on the books in Singapore. And, you know, is the government peering into everyone's bedroom and arresting them for oral sex? No. But on the other hand, if they ever need laws to turn against any opponents, they have hundreds and hundreds of laws on the books. They don't have to throw them in jail for political reasons. They can throw them in jail for oral sex or whatever else.
My guest is journalist Dan Sesser. He writes about Asia and is based in Bangkok. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.